Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up today, one of our most successful songwriters, Brendan Graham, and one of our most successful actors, Patrick Bergen, on their latest charity collaboration. Also today, photographer Mark Condren on his year spent with the NYPD. And we remember the remarkable Graham Jones, who we spoke to on this show last week and who died yesterday morning. Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie and you can find us on Twitter at Miriam O'Callaghan. Later on in this morning's show, we will of course be paying tribute to Graham Jones, who spoke to us last week, but who lost his fight against cancer yesterday morning. First up also, we have some competition tickets for you. I've got a pair of tickets actually today to see legendary Italian composer Ennio Morricone when he plays the Three Arena on the 15th of February. He's the man behind so many famous movie scores, such as The Untouchables and The Mission. Well, the question I have for you today to win two tickets to see Ennio and his orchestra perform live are just to answer this simple question. What's the name of another film that Ennio Morricone wrote the score to? The Good, the Bad and the... What's that word? No, you can't answer it in the studio here. Text your answer to me and your own name to 51551 and we'll announce the winner before the end of today's show. Well, with me this morning, first of all, is Mark Condren, who has won Press Photographer of the Year in this country four times. Well, for the past 2 years and involving 14 transatlantic trips, Mark of the Irish Independent and INM generally was embedded with the New York Police Department, the NYPD, to capture the force at work. The result is a wonderful book sitting in front of me now. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Miriam.
First of all, tell me how this book came about.
Yeah, I suppose it really started down in the village I'm from in North Cork, right in between Mallow and Fermoy, a place called Castletown Roach, where my father was stationed in as a Garda Sergeant for 37 years and he decided to retire. I went down and I said, Dad, can I follow you on your last day at work? And he was there, yeah, no problem. So we went around and met the community and Ben was small at the time, my son Ben, so he was going around in his little Garda uniform and done pictures of him around the village and stuff like that. So I had these photographs and they were kind of sitting on a laptop and I was there, no, something has to be done with these. These need to get out there and there's a little bit of history here.
Yeah.
So I decided then, after winning a couple of awards and stuff like that, people had said to me in Temple Street, would you do something for charity? And I said, okay, my wife's a guard. So I said, okay, let's do a coffee table book for Temple Street with these photographs. And I asked for permission of Faulkner Murphy, the Garda commissioner at the time. He gave me the permission to get in behind, in with the guards. Had it done that and the guards was born.
Yeah, and that was, and the important thing to say is all the proceeds from the first book you did about the Irish Gardaí went to Temple Street Children's Hospital.
Yeah, every bit of it went to Temple Street Hospital. And same as this, by the way, this is going to be going to the Police Foundation over in New York, which does all that kind of work, great charity work for the NYPD in New York as well.
So how did it come about? Okay, you did the one in the Irish Gardaí, right? You had a bit of an in there because, as you say, your dad, your wife, Gardaí. How did it come about that you did the same for the New York Police Department?
Yeah, so basically after 2 years, and it was really hard to get in there. By the way, as well, Miriam, this is a bit of history. This is the first time this has ever been done in the history of the NYPD. So to get that access is incredible. So basically I went over, I got in after 2 years of contacts, basically.
Yeah.
Got into the commissioner's office, handed him the book, which is like my business card, really, at this stage. And he turned around, he was there. The first thing he done, he just opened it. He said nothing, flicked through, and he was there. We've got to do this on the NYPD. And out we went.
And this was the American commissioner.
This was the James O'Neill, the American James NYPD O'Neill. Commissioner. James O'Neill. Yeah, I know.
He had a good name.
He had a good name. Now, in fairness, it did start with, I actually did pitch the idea to do the Irish Guards.
Yeah.
The Irish American police within the NYPD. That was the original pitch. And it started off that way. And then he turned around, he saw the way it was going and he was there, okay, hold this. Would you mind taking out the Irish side of it and just making it the whole NYPD. So That's what really made it then.
That must have been so interesting.
Oh, it was incredible. Like, it was like, if you think about it, Miriam, if you've been to New York, yeah?
Yeah.
And I bet you
love it.
Yeah, I love it. And most people that do, they turn around, they get out, the minute they hit New York or hit Manhattan, they start taking pictures of cop cars or a police officer. It's kind of the done thing.
Yeah.
When I landed there, the cop car outside the airport ready for me, and boom, off we went into the night and the excitement of it. It was brilliant. It was an amazing experience.
Did you get good access?
I did. I got incredible access. I got access to whatever I wanted, really. Like, as I said, it's a coffee table book. There was boxes to be ticked. Basically, you had to go into the aviation up in the helicopters, you had to do the water units, you had to do the horse units, you had to do the warrant squad. They have so many units. Their units across the NYPD it's massive. I just can't describe how big a police force it is.
And because you'd already done the one in the Irish Gardaí, how different are police forces? In other words, are they quite similar, but just on a massive scale, the NYPD?
You've answered it there. They're absolutely the very same. Like, I've gone to gun calls in Dublin. I've gone to stabbings in Dublin. I've gone to guards giving kids high fives. And I've done the exact same in New York. The only difference is, it's a bigger scale, it's faster. Like, it's so fast over there, Miriam. The way I had to do it was, obviously, I was out in the cop car as many times as I liked, but I had to pull out of that. I had to go, and so I ended up with my own driver, my own cop driver, in an unmarked car, and I'd had two radios. So I'd have a radio, a local radio, when we go into each district, so the 4-5, 4-6, 4-7, so on. And then I'd have a national radio that would go around all the boroughs, and then I'd have to pick the calls. So in other words, if I went into a cop car, you get a call for a disturbance in one of the projects, I could be stuck up there for 2 hours dealing with that. And time is an issue here, obviously. Like, I was dipping in and dipping out. So what I do is I pick the best of calls, basically, and we'd whiz around to all them.
And obviously, how do you make sure it's not just PR for the New York PD, YPD? Because we know they have big issues.
Yes.
There's big race issues over there. People feel they've targeted, you know, young black men. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, I can literally only photograph what's in front of me. So when I get there, I photograph what's in front of me. There is issues there. I'm not denying that. Absolutely. I personally didn't see it. It is a coffee table book at the end of the day, where I want everybody. If I did see somebody, we'll say, for instance, shot. I went to loads of shootings, by the way. But, like, they're not going to make the book. Like, as in, like, the gruesome of it is not going to make the book.
No.
It's a coffee table book. I want, we'll say, just going back talking about Ben there, I want Ben, Aaron or Emma to be able to read the book.
They're your three children.
They're my three children, yeah. I want them to be able to read the book. And I also want you to be able to pick up the book on a coffee table. So the gruesomeness of it, there is, like, you'll see, there is all sectors of it across there. I have a picture, as you can see here in front of me, I know your listeners can't see it, but there's a picture here. The 1 year anniversary of Officer Familia. She was a cop that was just sitting in the patrol car on the corner in the Bronx. A black male came up and basically put the gun to the window and blew her head off. They turned around, opened up fire, and shot that black male. So when I was there, I was there for the anniversary of it, and that's as close as I got to an officer shooting.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? So it was fire over and back.
I mean, I've known your photographs for years. So you've won, as I said at the beginning, press photographer 4 times in a row, or 4 years in Ireland. What makes a good photograph? I mean, what makes a great photograph?
Yeah, I suppose, listen, I'm only one photojournalist, and all my colleagues. I suppose what makes a great photograph is, Miriam, something that you can turn around and you can go, wow, that tells the story, I suppose. Like, I give a quick story. We'll say I remember the RTE news program on McHale and McConnell over in Peru.
Yes.
I went over and I covered that.
Yeah,
I was sent over to do that. So what covers whatever the RTE covered on that? I was sent to do that. I was sent into a city where a population, I don't know what it is, maybe 3 or 4 million, to find that person. As a press photographer, as a photojournalist, I had to find her. I went on to Airbnb. I looked where the interview was. I checked radiators, checked curtains. I had an idea through the apartments then where she might be. Went down, got the apartment. Lo and behold, here she's walking up towards me. They ran. I ran. That's photojournalism. I had to get that photograph in a city of millions of people. Found her. They did not want it photographed. they'd done everything to stop me being photographing them, but I photographed them and I got to photograph. And that's photojournalism. That's a good photography. There's only one side of it.
Now, do you feel bad? Because that's obviously success for you.
Yeah.
But is it, she didn't want that, obviously.
No, but like, yeah. No.
That's your job.
I think she deserves to be photographed, to be honest with you. No, I didn't feel bad at all. Sometimes you do feel bad. There's certain stories. Mm. Like there's in my job, Miriam, like it's there's very hard to get a balance. It's very high or low. You could be photographing somebody winning the lotto and the next job could be some mother after losing her four children.
Yeah.
You know, like it's very hard to get a balance and it's a very hard job that way.
And it's so powerful, photojournalism. I always think that I could be doing a story for ages and then one photograph.
Yeah,
can just say it all.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, and that's what we try to do, and that's not what we try to do. That's our job. Our job is like we're creating history here.
Mm. Something's going to last forever. The photograph, if it's a very good photograph,
absolutely.
People will look at it for years.
Yeah.
Before we went on air, it was interesting. We were talking about your son Ben because one of the reasons I think you gave all the proceeds from the first book on the Gardaí to Temple Street was because your son Ben has diabetes, doesn't he? Tell me about that and how your phone now is so important.
We're just talking about it earlier on. Yeah, I was just showing you. Ben is 12 now. He got diabetes when he was 14 months old. At the time, he was the youngest in Ireland and there are actually younger kids out there now with it. I suppose for a 12-year-old, it is, it's a hard thing to deal with. It's hard enough to be a 12-year-old, never mind dealing with diabetes and myself and Michelle telling him constantly, give yourself insulin for this, constantly give you, do this, do that. That's hard going on him. But technology has changed, yes. I can see him in real time now. Before, I remember him when he was 14 months old, picking up his little fingers and sticking needles into them 7-8 times a day. So that's moved on now. He's on a pump. So basically, I weigh his food all the time. So he's on a temporary basal rate all the time. So he's basically got a little machine outside him, which is acting as his pancreas, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the technology part of the phone side of it, I can see him in real time now. So he's in school. Michelle and I can see him going up or going down and His blood levels.
Yeah,
so he's got this little chip in him and it's constantly reading his blood sugars.
It's fascinating. 24.
It's fascinating. The technology that's coming along here is fascinating. It's unbelievable.
But do both of you then get addicted to looking at his blood? Do you manage to just lay off or are you constantly looking to see his ground?
I'm not as bad, I have to say. But
yeah.
In fairness, now it's tough going on Michelle.
Yeah,
she's constantly
like her,
at it.
Yeah.
But you set it. So we'll say he's going into, we'll say his blood sugars are 4. Probably you're about 4.55
okay.
now. So we'll say he's hitting 4. An alarm will ring on Michelle's phone. She's mine turned off. Because I'd be ringing her a good bit. So alarm will go off and tell us when he's going low. So there, or if he's going high, another alarm will ring on our phone and tell us. So you don't have to check it that much, but it would, because the alarms will tell you.
Now, back to your book. The lovely thing is you had a big launch for it, didn't you, in New York? The Irish Concert. Was that last week?
It was 2 weeks ago.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. Went over. Kieran Madden, in fairness, done a mighty job over there.
Who's Kieran Madden?
He's the Irish consulate in New York. Lovely, lovely man, actually. So we had everybody over there. There was about 60 people travelled from Ireland. We had the NYPD band came in and played in there, looking out onto the Empire State Building. It was fantastic. It was brilliant. Yeah. And it's getting a great reaction over there. Fox News. It was the third lead story in Fox News. You had Bush's funeral. You had a story on Trump. And then the book came, the third story on Fox News the other night.
It's a magnificent book, though, Mark. I'm not just saying that
because,
you know, I like you of a New York Police Department. Interesting as well, before we went on, we were chatting to Patrick Bergen because there's obviously a huge Irish connection in New York Police. And it turned out Patrick is a relation. Did he just tell you that?
He has. He's loads of relations in it, actually. You know what? He'd make a good cop, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he looks like it.
He's a few relations in the mounted unit, the horse unit over there. Yeah.
So finally, will you look now to another police department? What do you do now? You've done the Irish, you've done the New York PD.
It's take it easy for a while, I think. Get this over the line.
Stay at home.
Definitely stay at home for a while. I think the kids need to see me for a little bit.
And for anyone, because it's obviously going to charity, for anyone who wants to buy that, where can they get it, Mark?
They can get it on markcondren.com. It's markcondren.com. And it'll be in selected bookstores as well. But markcondren.com will be the quickest way of getting it out now.
Well, it's a beautiful book. Mark, thanks so much for coming in and chatting to me today.
I'll see you
out soon and about, probably in some job.
Absolutely. I'll probably see you next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark, thanks so much. We'll take a break.
Tweet @MiriamOcal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
And our text number 51551. You can find us on Twitter as well at Miriam O'Call. Some reaction there to the wonderful Mark Condren, who has a new book out in the NYPD. Miriam, Mark is a great photo in the book of Joe Canning hitting a snowball in New York. I've seen it. Absolutely fab photo indeed. And one more. Mick Breen in Kanturk says, I've been following Mark's career and fantastic work. He's a long way away from taking photos for the Corkman newspaper. That's all the very best from Mick in Kanturk. Well, sitting in front of me, it's an often used, overused word, legend. But I do have legends in front of me. One from Hollywood and one from the world of songwriting, all the way from Kong and Mayo. You'll all know You Raise Me Up, which since it was first released in 2002, has become one of the most recorded songs ever. It's been sung in more than 40 languages by more than 1,000 artists. Well, Brendan Graham, of course, wrote the lyrics to that song, and he's written a brand new song just in time for Christmas, and all of the royalties are going to Barnardo's charity. The song features Paul Harrington and the great actor Patrick Bergen. And Patrick and Brendan are both here. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Now listen, we're going to start off with the song, which is called Switzer's Window. Tell me about it. Who's going to take it up first? Tell me about it.
Okay, well, there was a little boy in Ireland once, long ago, in the middle of the country, but his dad was a dub, and every 8th of December, yesterday, that dad would bring the little boy to Dublin to see the lights and to see this magical window in Grafton Street, Switzer's Window, which ran from Grafton Street right around into Wicklow Street, and it had Santa Claus and elves and teddy bears and just wonder. And you'd stand three deep in a line, the line would move along, then you'd get up. So anyway, that little boy grew up and he went to London and then he went to live in Australia. But he never forgot Switzer's Window, because it wasn't just the window. It was Dublin, it was Ireland, it was home. So the little boy came back from Australia, and by then he had five little girls. And he used to bring the five little girls to Switzer's Window. And then the five little girls grew up, and then they used to want to bring their children there, but Switzer's Window was gone. So the little boy at the start of the story decided to bring it back in a song. That's how it came about.
And that little boy is Brendan Graham.
That little boy is a granddaddy little boy. And yesterday, the 8th, I was in town with my children and grandchildren. We've kept the tradition up that my dad started.
Which is wonderful. And to be fair, it's important to say that Brian Thomas have supported you in this as well, haven't they?
Brown, 100%.
Yeah, which is great, Patrick. So tell us about the song. How did you get involved, Patrick?
Well, I was a little boy once.
We're all little boys.
You're looking great, the pair of you.
I was born in Hollis Street, but I was raised for a while in Earlsford Terrace underneath the Labour Party offices. And my dad being... And he used to take me down Grafton Street across the green there. And we'd wander down Grafton Street past, dare I say, Woolworths.
Yeah.
And where we'd get the soft ice cream. And there used to be the Grafton Cinema, where there were often cartoons on. And we'd go down to Switzer's Window, and it was just magic. So when Brendan offered me the song to sing, I was absolutely delighted and responded instantly to it. If you're about to play it, I hope.
Now, so tell me about
it. Well, all I will say is that if whatever you're doing, listeners, please stop it just for the next 5 minutes and give yourself a treat and go back to Switzer's Window.
Let's listen to it now.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
That's beautiful. Brendan Graham and Patrick Bergen sitting in front of me. You love it, both of you. I can see that, don't you, Brendan?
Mm, yeah. It's a bit different. It's not a normal song in the sense that, you know, it's sung. So it's more like a little Christmas story with music. And of course Patrick has just this phenomenal voice that draws you in, and the brilliant John Sheehan. Everybody was so generous when I approached Patrick straight away, and I'd worked with Barnardo's before. He said absolutely, John Sheehan absolutely, Paul Harrington, Neil Martin on cello, and the wonderful choir from the Kyle Moore School of Music. Everybody said yes, and then we went to Brown Thomas, and I have to say, from the first day we went in, they embraced the whole notion of the connection to the past. They sponsored the record. They are selling it in all their stores for €5. Every single penny of that €5 is going to Bernardo's, as is all our royalties. And everybody was so generous. So
wonderful. I'll just bring you some of our listeners' reactions. Switches Wind, Miriam, that's pure magic. So nostalgic. Bernie then goes on to say, Miriam, that song is so poignant. It brought a tear to my eye in nostalgia and magic. Anne Costello says, beautiful song. Don't forget to mention the children from Calmore College Music. You just mentioned just them, did. Brendan. And Lisa McGuinness, their MD. They worked really hard. The atmosphere was beautiful on Grafton Street last Thursday for the launch. I'll bring in two more. Sue in Cork says, such a beautiful song, Miriam. Reminds me of my Dublin childhood. And Switzer's Window, great singing by Patrick. Another, Ina in Mullingar says, I love Brendan Graham and his music. I love that song. So full of nostalgia. I remember Brendan in Mullingar many moons ago. I love Patrick's voice. And I'll just bring you one more so we get to chat. Denise says, hi, I'm in the same vintage as the lads. I too have lovely memories of Switch's Window. Dying to see what the theme was every year. Brilliant song. Cheers. So that's nice to get reaction, just straight on live radio.
Absolutely. So your task is to go and visit Switch's Window today or tomorrow, which is now Brown Thomas, and go in there and buy it.
Yeah, and they will. And as you say, it's all going to Bernardo's. Brendan, you've written so many great songs. I've interviewed you before for people like, obviously, You Raise Me Up, Rock and Roll Kids, The Voice, Crook in the Porsche. As soon as you write them, do you let them go? And do you care more about some songs? Like, I can see you and I know you really care about this song. But do you care about them all, or some of them errant children or whatever?
They're all babies. You know, they're all babies. And you do have to cut the umbilical cord at some stage. But early on, I suppose I was more protective and possessive. Now I'm really happy if somebody says, you know, I love Patrick Bergen's new song. I'm happy, or if Josh Groban or Westlife, because once you write the song, it's not finished until it's heard. And you need, I can't sing and I can't play. So it needs people like Patrick and John Sheehan and all of these other very talented people to help the song to fly. And then what you want is for people to make it their own. If I can just tell a little story. I was walking once into the Shelburne to meet, I think it was Ronan Tynan, the tenor who sang at President Bush's funeral last week. And as I was walking in, there was a party. There was obviously a big dinner and a huge amount of people walking in. And this lady just broke away from the party and she walked alongside me for about maybe five steps. She didn't say who she was, where she was coming. And she just, it was the time of Rock and Roll Kids. And she just said to me, you must have known what was in my head when you wrote that song. And that was probably one of the greatest compliments, forgetting charts and everything else, that I ever got. That somehow something in solitude I had written had connected with another human being. And she went off, never saw her again, didn't know who she was or anything.
But it's so interesting when you said a minute ago, you know, you don't play, you don't sing. Where did your musical ability come from then? Remind people, and how did you get into songwriting?
Where did my musical ability come from? I suppose I was always interested. I remember we lived in Castle Island in Kerry.
Great
place. And there was one jukebox in the town, in a chipper. And you'd go down and you'd have to wipe the grease away to see, you know, the singles inside. And I was always really interested on, I'd be looking at who wrote that song. So, for example, I can tell you that Cliff Richard's Livin' Doll was written by Lionel Bart. And I'd be looking at that and then I'd look at the B-sides. And don't know why. I was always interested in who is the person behind the song, not the person who's going out there with it. So I always had that kind of interest. And then, like, when I was 16, it was the time of Elvis and the Beatles. I got a guitar and I had very curly hair, but I tried to sweep it back and grease it back into a DA. You know what a DA is, do you?
What is a DA?
It's a duck's ass, which was,
It
was all in the,
shape.
It was all the shape of the back of the...
Sounds beautiful.
So you know, we got into that. So there was a bit of music. And then, as you know, the story, I was an industrial engineer and I was made...
Remind people, because not everyone does know your story.
Okay, well, I went into industry to earn a living. I was an industrial engineer and in my late 40s and had been writing songs and loving it, but at night and at the weekend. And then I was made redundant. And I thought, okay, the whole question of going into writing songs or not. And I thought, well, it's up to me now, you know. you know, do it, put up or shut up. So I began to write full time in 1993, and then fortunately 1994 Rock and Roll Kids came up, and then Emer with The Voice in 1996. Mm. So it was random, and it taught me a lesson sometimes to be thankful for what's taken away as much as for what's given.
That's so interesting. Because you think if you hadn't been made redundant, you just might not have gone full time.
It wouldn't have happened. The songs wouldn't happen. I wouldn't be sitting here with you today and with Patrick, and we wouldn't be telling people to go into Brown Thomas and hand over Fiverr for Bernardo's.
That actually could be quite reassuring for even one person listening today, Graham, who perhaps is at a difficult moment in their own lives. Like, you didn't start that new career until your late 40s.
Yeah. Yeah. Very late 40s, yeah. So I do say it to people who are thinking about things, you know, well, I'm a very late convert, and then I didn't write my first book till I was 53. So everybody out there, you've got loads of time.
Get up. Get up. Go and buy the record and then write a book and sing a song.
Yeah. Exactly, Patrick.
And just for people to know, tell me about your background, Patrick. Tell us, remind people of your father, because he was very active, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a wonderful man. He was he became a Labour senator. He was a Labour organiser, and he started off in Carlow and led a very big strike down there at the sugar factory. He made a senator, came up to Dublin. I was born on Hollis Street and raised for a couple of years in Carlow. But then we moved up and lived underneath the Labour Party offices in Earlswood Terrace. The most important thing, I think, that for my dad, to keep it simple, is he said there were three things, in those days, we are able to say it, three things a man needs.
Okay.
A roof over his head, food on the table, and a flower in a vase.
Wonderful.
That's really wonderful.
And the flower in the vase is your spiritual creative life, in a way.
Yeah.
And so he kept it very simple, and he was just a wonderful guy. He was just a joy to be around. He was great crack.
And all the acting, where did that come from in your family?
Well, in the process of his work, he was organising farm workers in and around Carlow, especially around the time of the strike, because they used to pluck the sugar beet.
Mm.
And it began with the clap of the two sugar beets going together. And he, with respect to all those wonderful men, some of them could barely walk and talk at the same time. So my dad set up a theatre, the Little Theatre in Carlow, which still is going, in order to get his men confident and able to speak and talk. And there's a wonderful story of how during the strike, what had happened was when the sugar, it was the first industry to come into Ireland after the war, and Carlow was one at Mallow and various other places, but in Carlow, and they said that he'd never get away with it, but he kept the men together, and Major General Costello had struck a deal, because they didn't know how to make the sugar, so even in those days they had to import European labour from Czechoslovakia to teach them how to do it. But they made a deal that when they could do the same work, they would get paid the same wage. Major General Costello, when that moment arrived, reneged on his deal. And my dad called the strike and stopped the sugar beet being plucked in the fields. It was serious. And they called my dad a communist, and they put him in jail for 5 years. He said, well, you won't have sugar for 5 years. So eventually he said they'd negotiate, but they didn't want to negotiate with Paddy. And he said, no, you'll negotiate with me. So he and his cronies went up to Leinster House. And before they went in for the meeting, they were having tea and sandwiches. And they had saccharin even in those days. And my dad said, can we have some sugar, please? And the waitress said, there is no sugar. So, oh, why is that? Don't you know there's a strike on down in Carlow? And my dad says, oh, them hooligans, so to speak. And the waitress says, don't you dare say a word against those men. And my dad knew he was on a winner.
So interesting.
No.
Yeah, and he did. And he was carried head and shoulders into the town afterwards. But I think part of the price was he lost his job. And he went off to Port Arlington. He used to cycle into Port Arlington, the power station. And his life, you know, started I came on a little bit later, you know, and it was, sorry.
Did he know how successful his children went on to be, your dad?
Well, he did sit beside me on the Dublin premiere of Sleeping with the Enemy.
And what did he think of his son in Sleeping with the Enemy?
When the name came up on the screen, he said, "That's me." Because we have the same name, Patrick Bergen.
Yeah. He must have been proud, was he?
Oh, he was. He was very proud of it. And of Emmett as well, of course, and all his children.
Yeah.
And there was a wonderful... He read books. He had you know, it was not an intellectual so much. Well, I suppose it is a fair word to use. He would certainly discuss the subjects of the day and the important issues in life. And he believed he was the Father, Son, and the other fellow he used to call the Holy Spirit. Mm. He studied at the Holy Ghost Fathers as well. There was a moment when he might have become a priest himself.
Mm.
So he had a wide horizon of ideas and opinions, and but he was very focused also, and he did eventually work as a fitter in the Ivy Hostel, keeping the poor people warm, and he had his own office there in a way, and people would come in and ask him his advice because he was still connected in with the Leinster House. And in fact, I know what Brendan was saying there, but I have a song out at the moment as well called The Tipperary Waltz, which was I wrote, and Simon Casey's singing it. And it's lovely to have somebody else sing your words. And it was a great thing for him. He met Dan Breen, who also became a senator. And I'd like to say this because a lot of people said that Dan Breen had no conscience. And my father met him on the steps of Leinster House and said, asked Dan, he said, "What was it like to have killed a man?" And then it gave me my second verse of the song, because Dan replied, "The ghosts of those men haunt me every night."
Mm.
It did affect him.
Of course, that's so interesting.
Yeah. So it's wonderful that one can have, and I incorporated that into the song. But as Brendan was saying, it is a wonderful thing for other people to... And if you can have an effect, and I think music in general and songs like Sister's Window can affect people in a spiritual way.
Yeah, and actually from our audience, lots of reaction to your song, both you. Miriam, such magic, I'm crying here with memories about Switzers, thank you. Hugh in Stillorgan says, "Dear Miriam, that's the best song ever. Congrats to Brendan and Patrick and all who put it together. Well done to all. Memories are made of this." Niamh says, "My mom, Claire, was one of the creative team who made the magic of the Switzers and Brian Thomas Windows. Happens every year. So lovely to hear this song and with such a great cause. Happy Christmas." Anna Knockline says, "Hearing that beautiful song brings back so many memories, and I now don't care if I do not hear another festive song this year." I've too many messages. I can't read them all, actually. One more, actually. Sean O'Hargan Kilkenny says, "Miriam, the Labour Party in Carlow Kilkenny are very proud of former Labour Senator Paddy Bergen and, of course, his wonderful family." So that's nice. We're going to listen to a song, actually. We're staying with us. Since you mentioned earlier, you're talking about the power of music. You mentioned the woman going up to you telling you how much Rock and Roll Kids meant to her.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a little blast now of Rock and Roll Kids, written by you, Brendan Graham.
Okay. Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, I'm here this morning with one of our greatest songwriters, Brendan Graham, and one of our greatest actors, Patrick Bergen, who have collaborated together all for Barnardo's with the help of lots of people, including Brian Thomas, Neil Martin, John Sheehan, Paul Harrington and the Calmore Choir with Lisa McGuinness, and all the proceeds, they say, going to Barnardo's. You were also saying to me, Brendan, there during the break, that if they go onto iTunes and YouTube, tell me about them.
Yeah, we made a video, which is a beautiful video. It captures some of the recordings in the studio, and it also captures Patrick on Grafton Street with snow and remembering Switzer's Window. So that video is up on YouTube. And if your listeners would like to go and have a look at it there, there's also a link to iTunes where they can also purchase the song. And again, all the iTunes royalties are going to Barnardo's.
Fantastic. And I haven't the time to read all these messages, but lots of people saying it brought back so much nostalgia. And one more about you, Brendan, as well, saying thanks for your input into their Forgotten Mayo Famine Girls Remembrance in Ballinan in October. That's from Terry Riley and all the team.
Yeah, that was a song I wrote about the orphan girls who went to Australia under the Earl Grey scheme back in the mid-1800s. to help populate the colony. So they've erected a beautiful statue in Ballina, and we were down there to help them launch it, and the local choir under the direction of Regina DC sang the song, and it was just a wonderful day.
Fantastic. And Patrick Bergen, you love singing. I think you love singing more than acting, and you've got a concert, haven't you, in the National Concert Hall on January the 4th. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah, January the 4th, a show called Arish, and lots of wonderful people performing, including me, and I'll be singing the song Anthem, written by Leonard Cohen, which I sang for the Pope at Croke Park.
Yeah, that was a beautiful song. That was must have been a great occasion.
It was an absolutely magic occasion, yeah.
That's how we great got honor. Connected. It was
Tell
through
me.
That, because I had been waiting, as I said to Patrick, while Julia Roberts might have wanted him out of her life and the baddies in EastEnders might have wanted him, I've been waiting all my life for him to come along to be the right person to sing this song. And it was Tommy Swarbrick, who promoted my concert last year, said to me, I had sung it there with John Sheen. He said, why don't you get a singer to sing it? And I said, all right, Tommy, who? And he said, have a listen to Patrick Bergen. And I didn't know Patrick sang, so I did listen to Anthem at Croke Park, and straight away I said to Tommy, how can I get in touch with him? So it's the circularities of life. Everything
Absolutely.
Is connected.
And talking about life, well, first of all, I just want to announce the winner. We had almost 2,000 people saying they wanted these tickets to Ennio Morricone this morning. But the winner, you're very lucky, is Tom Savage from Dunleary. Congrats to you, Tom. I hope you enjoy your time going to see Ennio Morricone. Stay with me, actually, Brendan and Patrick. But before we go this morning, I want to pay tribute to a truly remarkable man, Graham Jones. You may have heard him on this show just last Sunday. We had a massive reaction at the time to his interview. I had the immense privilege of speaking to Graham and to his wife, Louise, and his brother Rob. He's a man of great faith, Graham. He's just 42 years old and a father to three very young daughters. He'd spent his life working with disadvantaged young people, touching the lives of those in Dublin's inner city. And he gave up his very high-powered job as a lawyer to work full-time to help set up an inner city project called the Solace Project. He'd also just become a priest in the Church of Ireland, joining his brother Rob, who is a priest in Rathmines in Dublin. Well, when we spoke last week in this studio, Graham knew he was terminally ill with cancer, something he faced with extraordinary courage. Everyone who heard him speak last weekend commented to me on his profound courage, calmness and honesty. During the interview, Graham said that it was the love of his family and his great faith which was helping him deal with his mortality. Well, Graham died yesterday morning. According to his brother Rob, it was beautiful. Graham was surrounded by Louise and their three little girls, and everyone had the chance to say what they needed to say. It was, said Rob, exactly what Graham had wanted. Rob will be the priest at Graham's funeral next Tuesday, which he says is a huge honour. Before we go today, and with the permission of his family from his interview last week, I wanted to bring you something of what Graham said about dealing with his terminal diagnosis and facing his mortality. At one stage, I asked him about whether his faith is helping him.
Well, I firmly believe it is. Mm. And I say that, though, reluctantly, because I don't want anyone to feel bad about them not dealing with it well. Mm. Because I don't feel like I'm doing anything in my own strength. And I suppose one of the things that does really frustrate me when I hear people's language is when they say people talking about battling cancer. And I find that actually very offensive, because people can't battle cancer on their own because it's outside their control. Mm. And then when you hear language like, oh, somebody lost their battle to cancer, that nearly puts blame on that person or pressure on that person. Mm. And for me, if there's a message to anybody who's trying to support somebody going through cancer, is to stop using that language, you know, and just take the pressure off the person to say it's actually not within your control, and just to try and live every day as best you can and finding the joy in every moment. And I suppose within that, I've been asking my friends a question: what is a flourishing life, Miriam? Mm. And it's been so interesting just to hear the response from people in them experiencing my suffering. And I think I would hope that that's bringing out more in them in understanding the joy of life and the gift of life. And I can honestly say that in the midst of all that we are experiencing, in the last 2 or 3 years, like between myself and Louise in particular, in our own marriage, I've never experienced such intimacy that I would have thought was possible in such a time of suffering. Without sounding in any way pious or over religious, I just feel a sense of joy and peace. And because, you know, God says that peace, His peace will transcend human understanding. Mm. And I just have that real sense of joy and that real sense of peace.
Well, that was the truly remarkable Graham Jones speaking to me just last Sunday on this show. And of course, Graham died yesterday morning. We played that with the permission of his family. Well, Culla Sov Graham, in a moment, we're going to end the show and we're going to play one of your songs, actually, Brendan, The Family Love It, You Raised Me Up, for Graham Jones, his wife, Louise, his three little girls, Rebecca, Amelia and Romy, his brother, Rob, and of course, his wider family. When I told you both I was going to play that clip from Graham, you both were interesting just talking in general about faith and how you approach that at this stage of your life, Brendan.
Well, first of all, that was very, very touching there, and it's a great honour that the family would think that something that one had done could perhaps bring some comfort, and I quite don't know what to say. I suppose the longer we live, thankfully, I've had good health and so on. I get up every day loving what I'm doing and loving life. But you do get reflective, so you go through a different period. So probably at this stage now, I'm writing quite differently, probably what I would call, and I don't mean this in a morbid way, it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but sort of end-of-life songs, looking back and thinking about life and family and all that. So, yeah, it's, I found that quite moving.
Oh, sorry, Brendan. Patrick, you...
Yes, it's very moving to hear that, and especially his faith in the moment. I believe in the Nunc et Semper, now and forever, and I believe all things possible in infinity.
Well, look, Patrick Berg and Brendan Graham, thank you both very much. Thank you both for bringing in your songs with his window. It's a beautiful song. My thanks and sound today to Dave Gibson, to our BCO, Andrew Dupreer, our producer, Sean O'Gorman, and for you, Graham Jones, what a remarkable person you are. This song is for you and your family.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.